will start today by opening a public hearing on our last bill on the agenda, just to keep you all on your toes. House Bill 2311, Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2311 is at the request of the House Interim Judiciary Committee for the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Cities, the Oregon Collectors Association, Judicial Department, and others, eliminates the court facilities and local court facilities accounts, sets the interest on judgment, the statutory rate set forth in ORS 82.010 of 9% per year, allows the state court administrator to waive interest for the purpose of administering collection of judgments from state courts, allows municipal court judges and justice of the peace courts to do the same, requires the payments be applied first to principal, then interest, and allows money collected as interest in state court to be used to pay costs of collection, and that money's left over to be paid the criminal injuries compensation account.
Okay. We have signed up Sarah Gates and Jim Marquis.
Good afternoon, Chair. For the record, Sarah Gates with the Oregon Judicial Department. We're here to tell you a little bit about House Bill 2311. I want to take just a couple minutes to walk you through why this bill is important to the Judicial Department and what it does. Currently, the way the statutes are written, we are supposed to start charging interest on criminal judgments as of July 1 of this year, and the money would then go to a court facilities account. Our systems are not able to perform those calculations. We have not been calculating interest and would not be able to on July 1. When the last legislation was passed to extend the deadline to this July, we thought we'd be farther along with the replacement of our legacy systems. We are underway with that, and it's part of our strategic plan, but we are not there yet. So what this bill does several things. First of all, it connects the rate of interest charged to that in 82010, so it's a flat 9% per year, eliminating the split rate that's currently in statute. It has all the money collected on judgments going to satisfying the principal first and then going to the any interest that has been calculated. All remaining money that finally does apply to interest will go to the criminal injuries compensation account. This arrangement will continue until January 1, 2012, at which point any interest collected on restitution will be paid to the person in whose favor the award was made. That's pretty much a summary of what the bill does from the Judicial Department's perspective.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Senator Barr.
Thank you. Just the part that requires payments first be applied to principal and then interest. Doesn't that, I mean, that's backwards. Normally, when you make payments on something, you satisfy the current interest, and anything that's left over, you apply that toward principal.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, how are you ever going to get the interest paid off if you're only making principal payments?
Chair Burdick. Senator Beyer, that's a good question, but the way this was thinking is part of a negotiation with the crime victims groups, and that way more money is getting to victims first as opposed to interest going to a generic account.
But I guess to follow up, at what point in time, I mean, the interest is accruing, is that going to continue to accrue? And, it, you know, I guess explain to me how this is going to work.
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, the A engrossed version of the bill has the interest only continuing to accrue for 20 years, and at that point it ceases to accrue. You're correct that in some cases it will take a very, very long time to pay off that interest amount, but more of the money will be going to the actual victims.
Okay, now I'm confused. What does it accrue on the basis of?
Yeah.
Interesting. What does it accrue on the basis of? Maybe we should hear from Mr. Marquis and see if he can elaborate
sure.
on that.
You shed some
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. I was part of a work group that got together relative to this statute prior to the session, and we all agreed to move forward in with this bill. There had been legislation passed that would have had all interest on criminal judgments accruing to this court facilities account. And frankly, the way the statute was drafted and the way that that money has to be doled through this matrix, there are several categories of funds that it has to go through, and the interest would have, there was part of the interest would have went one place and part of the interest would have went another place. It would have created an accounting nightmare both for counties and for the court system here. And I don't think they could have done it. So in addition to that, the legislature last session had created a statute that, I think it was last session or the session before, that at a date certain, interest on criminal judgments would have been 12.5% for the first 5 years or something, and then 3.5% after that. That also would have created an accounting nightmare for collection agencies doing work in this area and for state agencies or for the judicial department and for local courts. So this was an effort whereby we came to an agreement to delay the implementation of interest on criminal judgments for an additional period of time, whereby the interest rate on criminal judgments would be 9% as prescribed under 82010 for which is the legal interest rate, legal rate of interest statute for all these kind of judgments and all these kinds of things. The House Judiciary Committee, and particularly the chair, was concerned that 9% going on forever on a criminal judgment, criminal judgments, if you don't know, are good for 50 years now under the statute. We could have had 9% accruing for up to 50 years, and he thought that was too punitive. So we limited the interest to the first 20 years, as it would be in a civil judgment, and no interest would accrue on these judgments past that date. As to the issue of that Senator Beyer addressed with respect to where the money would be applied, there is a because of the victims that get some of the principal amount of this money, they wanted the money applied to principal first. We made that provision apply only to interest collected by the judicial department, that is the state court system. That same rule would not apply to municipal courts or to justice courts. They would be free to account for those funds in the same manner that they do now, so they wouldn't have to change any system. And those, I might say that justice courts and municipal courts all do that probably differently. I mean, there are all kinds of arrangements out there with people. We have collection agencies collecting these judgments for justice courts, for municipal courts. In some cases, they share in the interest between the collection agency and the justice court. In other cases, they don't, and usually that the issue of how you apply funds is usually a contractual in the private sector, for instance. It's a contractual issue between the client and the collection agency as to how that gets accounted for in these payments. So for the state, probably makes sense, not probably for justice and municipal courts, and we left that alone, as I said. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions. Does your head hurt,
yeah,
Madam Chair?
Yeah, my head hurts.
Sorry.
I still haven't heard an answer to the question of if the principal is paid off first and goes to the victims, then how does the interest accrue?
The interest would not accrue once the principal was paid. In other words, if someone owed $100 and it was 10% interest and they didn't make any payment for a year, there'd be $110 owed, and then if they made a $10 payment, that $10 payment would be applied, but and they would owe $100, but they would still owe the $10 in interest and only $90 in principal at that point, and then the interest that would accrue
on the $90.
Okay, yes.
So basically, if they paid off the whole $100. Say they don't pay off anything for a year, and they pay off $100, that $100 would completely pay off the principal.
And they'd owe $10 in interest.
And the $10 in interest would not continue to accrue interest.
No.
All right. Okay. At least I understand it.
I wish I could get a home loan that did that.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I just want to let the committee know that although it does not have a technical conflict with another bill that we passed out here, it's in the House Judiciary Committee, that Senate Bill 629, which establishes that money judgments against incarcerated persons do not accrue interest until the person is out of custody. And as you may look at this bill on page 1, lines 13, criminal judgments do not bear interest after expiration of 20 years. So theoretically, if someone were in prison for 20 years, they wouldn't have to pay any interest at all, because it would, by the bill that's in the House, it would not accrue, and then by this bill it would end. And Darren Stanford's been working with Senator Walker, who was the sponsor of Senate Bill 629, to come up with an amendment to address that potential problem.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Pardon?
I said thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. All right. Anything else to add?
No.
Other questions? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2311. Hang on to that one for a while. Okay. Now, let's go to the top here. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2124.
Okay, ma'am.
Top
thank
of
you.
Our public
just
hearing.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2124 is filed at the request of Attorney General Hardy Myers of the Department of Justice. Clarifies that the Department of Justice Child Support Program has the same statutory authority that other state agencies have to contract with other financial institutions to pay garnishment search fees on a periodic basis instead of paying each time a garnishment is delivered to the financial institution. Establishes that a child support judgment is terminated upon the effective date of a later issued child support judgment rather than when the judgment was entered. Requires that withholding from income in a child support matter begin no later than the first pay period occurring 5 days after datum of the order to withhold. Allows the employer to start withholding no later than the second pay period occurring after the date of the order to withhold it. On the date the employer receives the order, the employer had already calculated the payroll period and then prepared the paycheck or submitted a deposit for the payroll.
Okay. Thomas Hedberg. So used to seeing Ronell on these. Welcome.
She's much prettier than I am. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Thomas Hedberg. I'm a manager with the Child Support Program. I'm here today to talk to you about 2124, which is we characterize as our housekeeping bill. Before I begin there, maybe I would clear the air about some things in the recent newspapers and the reports about 10,000 of our statements going to the wrong people. I don't know if you were interested in that, but I can share what we have done in regards to that at this point if you're interested.
Actually, we would like to hear that. Thank you.
We recently had a new contractor who sent out our statements, and that's the amount of money that was received for child support to each person who receives that, and they get a notice of this is how much is received, and so they can track their records and compare that to the checks they receive. Our new contractor, in putting those together, they're two-sided form, one's on top of the other. In their attempt to send it out, they mismatched about 10,000 of them, so what you have is the addressee. And the information on the inside did not coincide. So they were actually getting the next person down the line's information. Now, in that information is their name and the case number and the amount of money. There were no identifiers that would allow them access to the rest of the case. We have several ways that people can check their balances and get information about their case, one through our website and one through our IVR system. The phone system that requires three pieces of ID to get through those. You'd have to have a Social Security number as well as a date of birth.
And none of that was on the phone.
None of that,
that
was included
through
in our statements.
So what happened to your old contractor?
I do not know. I'm sorry. I was not part of what happened in regards to that. This is a new contractor. We then, when we found the contractor, actually discovered it after they had sent out the 10,000, and they contacted us. We gave them a letter to put on the next one, asked them to immediately correct it and send them out again, and asked people to disregard those. During the same period of time, a client came forward to in Roseburg and shared concern about information, personal information being shared with others, and we understand that concern. We would like to keep that information as confidential as possible. It is very important to the child support program that their information is confidential. Our director this morning advised all employees to use extra caution in responding to phone calls. Generally, we'll accept the person's name and their case number and start talking about information, but we'll be more cautious about that for a period of time just to be sure nobody has taken advantage of what has happened.
Okay, well, keep us informed if there are any other further problems. Are there any questions on this report? Okay, on the bill, 2124.
There are five sections to the bill. Section one looks to deal with writs of garnishment. At this point in time, the Department of Justice does not have the ability to request that financial institutions bill us on a monthly basis. We do lots of writs of garnishment to financial institutions where we find money that a non-custodial parent has in an account of some kind, and they are behind in their payments or have not been making payments. We generally have to send a check for each time that we do this. What we are asking for is to join other state agencies who have an exception to this and be able to just be billed monthly. This would help us in not having to cut as many checks as we currently have to do and speed our process up.
Has there been any opposition to that?
No, there is not.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Section 2 deals with governing child support judgments. On occasions, more than we would like, more than one order is entered in regards to a child support matter, be it an administrative process or judicial or multiple judicial orders. When we go to reconcile the payment history and which order should be the controlling order, or the order that shall be in charge from this point, we ran into some issues in the statute where it currently reads, affected the date the judgment was entered. Well, quite often in orders, the actual beginning pay date for the amount of child support is in advance of that or past, and so we'd have a situation where that money that is owed should have been governed by the last order that was entered, but in fact it says the date the order was entered as opposed to when it was affected to begin paying that support. And we would like to reconcile that and just change that one section to make it affected the date of the judgment. Section 3 are changes that were proposed by legislative council in drafting, and they were supposedly just minor things of which we didn't request. Section 4, this is our income withholding statute, and we were having some conversations with employers, and some employers' attorneys questioned whether they had to withhold in the manner that the statute they didn't agree with our interpretation. Initially it said that you had to withhold within 5 days since the first payday, before the first payday. What would happen is they would believe that they had an extended period of time. We look to change this to make it clear. Representative Cameron, when we were before the House committee, had some concerns that even in our attempt to bring clarity, that this did not clarify the issue. So we met with him and worked out a compromise language. Attached to this, you will find a monthly chart which kind of spells it out day by day of when an employer would have to withhold, so that we have there's no question as to what day they would have to. We really looked forward to working with the employers so that we didn't put them in a position where they had already cut a check and would have to go back and redo that check. But we wanted to make sure that the money continued to flow in a timely manner to the families that were required to those funds. Section 5, federal statutes require that the Department of Justice, Division of Child Support, share information with Department of Human Services, especially in regards to TANF and medical services provided by the state. Our statute had some ambiguities about whether we could share that information when someone was making an application for services. We wanted to clarify that yes, by federal requirements, we are required to share that information even when the person is making an application for those services with the Department of Human Services.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Hedberg? This looks like a kind of boring housekeeping bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Byer.
In section four, the issue that you dealt with, or worked with Kevin, Representative Cameron on, I'm recalling, I don't remember now if it was this session or last session, dealing with orders to withhold garnishments for employers within 2 days of payday or something like that. And was that this session? Or is that
another one?
That was last session?
Yeah.
Is that, how does that, I mean, is that all meshed with this? Did this bring that, did that bring this on? Or, I mean, I remember that, I don't know if you remember that or not, but it was dealt with.
Do you know the answer to that?
No, I do not. This was brought on by the differences we were having with some employers and their attorney's translation of the 5 day that they required within the 5 day limit. I do not, this was not, there was no 2 day part of this statute.
Counsel?
And Chairman of the Committee, Senator Bayer, I don't know the exact details, but this issue has been before us on several occasions as it relates to garnishing of wages and withholding. And Ronelle Schenkel's in the audience, and I know she may have been the person that was carrying the bills for the Department of Justice. And I do know that this was an issue that on the House side, as you mentioned, Representative Cameron had a very much an interest in this area, and I believe the Department worked with him to accommodate his concerns, and they in the Dash 8 amendments were adopted in the House.
Yeah, refresh our memory, because you were here last session when I remember vaguely doing something in this regard, too.
For the record, Ronelle Schenkel with the Department of Justice. There are three pieces constantly floating around here. To clarify, Tom's talking about income withholding, which is specific to child support and is in Chapter 25. Different set of standards than garnishments, which is a collection tool that many other entities use. We also use garnishments, as he mentioned, but that's not what we're amending here. And then you may be recalling our discussions about distribution of child support, which has a federal mandate that we must distribute anything that's collected or paid within 2 days, Senator Bayer.
Okay. More information I want to know, I think.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Ronelle. Okay. Any other questions? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2124, and we only have the three of us here, so if anybody has a problem, probably wouldn't be a good idea to open a work session, but I don't see any distress, so I will open a work session on House Bill 2124.
I'm sure I move House Bill 2124A to the floor for the pass recommendation.
Senator Bayer has moved House Bill 2124A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection. So ordered. Senator Bayer, would you like to carry this?
Great.
Senator Bayer, would you be willing to carry this?
I guess so.
Okay. What a sport. Okay. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2225.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2225 comes at the request of Governor Kulongowski for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Allows a fire service professional employed full-time with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to maintain his or her professional certification as a fire service professional, even though not employed by a firefighting department. Establishes that the DPSST employee who was certified as a police officer, certified reserve officer, corrections officer, parole and probation officer, a fire service professional, a telecommunicator, or an emergency medical dispatcher is considered a full-time public safety officer in their certified discipline for the purpose of denying, revoking, or suspending certification, eligibility to apply for benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund, and eligibility to be honored as a fallen law enforcement memorial.
Okay. Marilyn Lawrence? Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I oversee the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. To give you a little bit of background on the reason that the department requested this bill be brought forward, in general, a person must be employed by a law enforcement or fire service agency or a 911 dispatch center in order to be eligible for certification and subject to jurisdiction of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, or DPSST. although the department is the regulator and the core training provider for these public safety professionals, DPSST is not itself a law enforcement agency, a firefighting agency, or a 911 dispatch center. Oregon law has recognized, however, that the department's certified staff members are continuing their public safety careers as they work to regulate and to train the public safety professionals around the state. ORS 181-651 currently provides that these individuals are eligible to hold and retain their public safety certifications as they work in the appropriate positions for DPSST. The last count that I made, which was about a month ago, that we had 41 individuals who held one or more public safety certifications who were full-time DPSST employees. In a couple of provisions, however, Oregon law excludes those who work for the department due to the way the provisions are written. House Bill 2225 would bring consistency to the way these public safety professionals are treated within Oregon law. It would provide that any DPSST staff member who holds certification through their work at DPSST and is killed or permanently and totally disabled in the line of duty would be eligible to be considered for benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund. It would allow them eligibility for inclusion on the statutorily created law enforcement memorial wall, and it would provide that they would be subject to the same denial and revocation standards as apply statewide to other certified individuals who are discharged for cause from their certifiable positions. As an agency, the department profoundly hopes that none of these proposed changes will ever need to be applied. We exercise rigorous safety protocols in all of our training environments and in all of our venues, and we believe that our staff members believe in and adhere to the highest of ethical standards. But we also believe that it is important that Oregon law provides full recognition and consistent treatment for the public safety professionals who work for the department as they advance professionalism and equip public safety professionals to work for these public safety agencies throughout the state. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay, in the bill, one of the things that they would maintain the certification for is determining eligibility to apply for benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund. And is that fund only for people who were killed in the line of duty?
Chair Burdick, yes, either killed or permanently and totally disabled.
Okay. And so all of these are determining eligibility to be honored at the memorial created. Which that last line of the bill, 22 and 23, can you say a little bit more about that memorial?
Chair Burdick, the law enforcement memorial was created, I believe, in as part of the passion of Governor Attia. And last week, in fact, the law enforcement memorial ceremony was held at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. There is a granite memorial to honor those who have been killed in the line of duty within the state of Oregon. And currently, a department a certified member of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training who, for example, was killed in a training accident alongside a public safety officer on our venue would not be eligible to be included in that wall, although the student that they were training would be able to be included. They would have been killed in the same training incident, and only one of them would be eligible for inclusion on the wall.
Okay. Well said. Senator Pruszynski.
Thank you. If I understand this correctly, one of the things that we're trying to do is make sure that DPSST can, in fact, if necessary, revoke someone's certification if it was deemed the appropriate thing to do. And my understanding currently that someone could be disciplined for, let's say, inappropriate conduct from a department, but DPSST today does not have the authority to actually revoke that certification, so that individual could in fact apply to be hired somewhere else within the state without DPSST taking whatever steps it would think would be necessary through the proper rules, et cetera. Is that correct?
Chair Burdick and Senator Pruszynski, that's close to correct. There is a narrow statutory provision that if an individual has been discharged for cause from their position as a public safety professional, that denial or revocation of certification is mandatory. So an employer can exercise discipline within the the realm of the individual's employment, and that does not trigger denial or revocation by the department based on discharge for cause. But discharge for cause, if the conduct rises to the level of discharge for cause and meets our definition, we would not currently be able to revoke the certification of someone who worked for the department, although we would be required to revoke that certification for someone who worked for another public safety agency.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you for getting that on the record, because it was a little unclear here how that came down. Okay, any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2225 and open a work session on House Bill 2225. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2225 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2225 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. I'll carry this one. Okay, open a public hearing on House Bill 2226. Council.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2226 comes to you at the request of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. Clarifies that the fees the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training receives from private security providers and investigators are to be used to pay DPSST's expenses associated with regulation of private security providers and investigators.
Okay, we have signed up on this one, Brian Henson. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Henson. I am the program manager for the Private Security Private Investigators Licensing Program at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. On January 1st of 2006, the Private Investigators Program transferred to DPSST as a result of House Bill 2117 last session. I came to DPSST and was put in the program area that I had been acting as the program manager under the private security certification program, because the two programs were very alike. They shared the same common denominators, a certification process, a regulatory process, and a fingerprint process, as well as training requirements. So on the surface, they mirrored each other and they came together quite well. What this bill is hoping to do is hoping to allow us to remove redundancies that take place within the program. They are currently administered in tandem, but the way that the budget is set up is that the two programs have dedicated funding. So what we have is a lot of duplication. We have certification going on, or processing of certification going on under the private security side. We have processing of certification going on under the investigator side. And you see that across the board. So what we're trying to do is pool the funding into one program area funding source, so that we're able to then remove those redundancies and move resources to appropriate levels to cover the entire program more adequately.
Okay. Any questions from the committee? All right. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2226. Open a work session on House Bill 2226. Senator Beyer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2226 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer has moved House Bill 2226 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objection. So ordered. Senator Pruszynski, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
Okay. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2233.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2233A comes to you at the request of the Department of Revenue. Allows the Department of Revenue to record with the Department of Consumer and Business Services a lien for deferred taxes on a manufactured home. Clarifies that Department of Revenue has a lien not only for the deferred taxes but also interest on the deferred taxes. Allows the Department of Revenue to record the Secretary of State's office a lien for deferred taxes on floating homes. And, Chair, members of the committee, this would give similar treatment that are now received in other homes that are attached to land.
Did this bill start out in Revenue Committee, or how did we get this bill?
Madam Chairman, as a committee, this bill started out in House Judiciary Committee and has worked its way across to Senate Judiciary Committee.
It's a little different than a lot of our bills, but that's okay. We're here to serve. Do we have somebody signed up on this? Anybody signed up? I think I lost my sign-up sheet.
Sorry. We have not it.
Aha, John Phillips. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue, and you're correct. This is a tax administration bill. It did come to judiciary, I think, maybe because of the lien issues in the statutes, but what it fundamentally does is it corrects and conforms some provisions for the department effectuating its lien against certain manufactured structures for the deferral program. And a couple of you are on or have been on the Revenue Committee and are probably familiar with the senior deferral program that allows seniors to stay in their homes when they cannot afford to pay their property taxes. And the fund that supports that program is basically supported through the collection of the advanced payments. There's a lien placed on the property, and when the property transfers, sells, or otherwise is refinanced, the department then recoups its money through that lien and then is able to pay the taxes of future applicants. So it's kind of a self-funding revolving account. One of the issues that came up was with some legislation that was passed in 2003 that became effective in 2005, and that was to move all of the licenses for manufactured structures from the DMV, licensed with license plates, to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, where there's ownership documents created. And so they now manage that ownership record. And some of the language didn't track real well, and so this bill sort of conforms some of that from recording in the county clerk to more like filing with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So that's primarily what the bill is about. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Now, in the staff made a summary, and I realize you don't write that, Mr. Taylor did, but it says that the manufactured homes are treated as personal property rather than real property when the land upon which the home sits is owned by someone other than the person who owns the home. But isn't a manufactured home considered personal property unless it is put on a foundation, even if it's on the land that is owned by the same person who owns the home?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, actually, in the property tax law, it's not. It's only considered real property when it's owned by the same individual, the same person, same entity.
So as long as it's owned by the same entity and on a foundation, it's considered real personal or real property, correct? As long as it's still on wheels or and not on a foundation, it's still considered personal property, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, for the purposes of property taxation, there's the distinction between real and personal.
Yes.
And the real critical part of that is the mobility of the property for collection purposes. If you own a home, a stick-built home, and it's on a site of land, you're not likely going to be able to move that, and so there's a foreclosure proceeding in which the county can take your property for lack of payment of your property taxes. But because manufactured structures can be mobile, then they can move from place to place, and so they're considered as personal property for the property tax laws only because of the collection element, and that is because these collection steps are different. Rather than foreclosure, there's a seizure process.
But Senator Beyer's question was, is there a difference in how they're treated if they're on wheels versus whether they're on a foundation? Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, I guess I'm just trying to get clarification. And if a manufactured home is owned by me and it's sitting in a manufactured home park which is owned by someone else, it's my personal property. But if that manufactured home is sitting on property that I own, so I own both the property and the land, or both the house and the property, that home is still considered personal property, is it not?
Senator Beyer, no, not necessarily. Only if the ownership is recorded the same. If you own it as, let's say you and your wife own it versus the land, and just your name is on the manufactured structure, whether it's on wheels or on a foundation or whatever, they would be treated differently under the property tax laws.
Why is that?
I think that's what I said, though, isn't it?
I'm sorry if I misunderstood your question.
So they're treated differently if they're owned by different entities, you're saying?
If the ownership is not identical, yes.
Okay.
So if the ownership is identical, then it would be treated as real property?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
When has that changed?
Did you want to say something, Mr. Taylor?
No, Madam Chairman, that was basically the same question I was going to ask. I went through the same thing before the bill was heard in the House side, trying to figure out
and this
what
bill,
is it personally and what is it realty. And,
yeah. And this bill only affects the personal property manufactured structures because they are registered differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Pazansky.
I assume the history is there that you would, as you would apply to the stick house, that's not, the property normally is not owned by someone else, meaning the ground. And so in this case where you have a mobile home that's on someone's property, meaning the same owner, you're looking at it or the department's looking at it as something that's more likely than not is going to be moved and transported somewhere else as compared to if it's in a mobile home where they don't control the land, it could in fact become mobile with or without wheels, meaning that they could put them on and take it off.
Yes, that's correct. So this bill primarily just deals with effectuating our lien to make sure that because the ownership is handled not in a county clerk's office and recorded, but in an ownership document that's recorded with a state agency, that lien is secure for the purposes of the deferral, you know, this money that's been advanced by the state of Oregon.
Are you satisfied with this, Senator Barr?
Yeah, no, I understand what the bill's trying to do. I'm trying to make sure that there, because I thought there was a difference between a manufactured home put on a foundation, i.e. Mm-hmm. basically made permanent, versus one that was never put on a foundation. Apparently there isn't.
And you're saying that doesn't, that's not what the difference is?
Madam Chair, Senator Barr, I'm pretty limited in my expertise to the property tax area. I know Don Miner is here and might have an idea. I don't mean to put him on the spot, but...
He's back there nodding agreement.
There you go, Mr. Miner. You've been summoned.
I'm sorry, Don.
Thank you, John. Don Miner, Manufactured Housing Association. My understanding is it's ORS 308-875. Says that the person who owns the land owns the house, it's real property, without regard to the foundation, wheels, what have you. And that's longstanding. Hope that answers the question, Senator Byer.
Well, again, Madam Chair, let me ask a follow-up then. If I own a piece of property that has a mortgage on it through, you know, XYZ Bank, I then go and purchase a manufactured home and use ABC Bank to purchase that and put it on top of this piece of property. Is that now considered two different owners because there's two different lending institutions who have the mortgages or the on one on the land, a different one on the home? So then they would then the home in that scenario would be taxed as personal property?
I think it's so real at that point.
Yeah, if the home and land are owned by the same person, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Senator Byer, it's real property. In terms of the mortgages, the priority of mortgages,
they just have a secure interest.
Yeah, there's one would be secured in the land. Whether or not the home would become a fixture, it gets more complex than I could answer. But I would assume that the mortgage on the house would be a purchase money loan, and that the that person granting the mortgage would have priority as to the house.
Thank you.
Okay. Before we get into any more depth in this, I will close any other questions. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2233. Open a work session on House Bill 2233. Senator Byer.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2233 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer has moved House Bill 2233 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Byer, even though you have a current and a former Revenue Committee person here, I'm going to ask you to carry this bill because you seem to really get this stuff.
Obviously not, because I didn't know what it was.
I crashed course in it.
Okay, now that our third vote is here, we are going to, just in the nick of time, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2129 for council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2129 is at the request of Attorney General Harder Myers from the Department of Justice. Increases a limitation for administrative costs of the Oregon Department of Justice may charge for administration of the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Service Fund from 5% to 10%. I see Ronell Schenkel in the back of the hearing room, and if you need any, and I also can leave someone else from the Department of Justice here to testify.
Okay, we have help if we need it, but we had the public hearing on this relatively recently. I'm prepared to take a motion from either Senator Persansky or Senator Walker on this bill, and
sure.
Also prepared to bring people up if we need them.
I'm sure I'll move House Bill 2129A to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Persansky has moved House Bill 2129A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. I will be opposed to the motion. I understand what the department wants to do, and I understand why they need this increase, but also in after further discussion with them in my office, my frustration is that not specifically this fund, this agency, this account, but there are also apparently at least two other similar funds, agencies, accounts that these local providers have got to write grant applications to in order to receive these funds. So we have local providers having to have grant writers. We then have to have at least three different people in three different places reviewing, reading these grants and deciding who's going to get the money. And so then you've got where this, you know, is a pretty reasonable administration fee of less than 10%. When you add everything else together, we're never going to streamline if we keep increasing administration percentages for each of the different groups that have to go through rather than make them all do it once or just send the money out to them. Don't make them write grants until we have to have grant writers and grant readers. You're never going to get there if we keep doing it this way, so I'll be opposed to the motion.
Well, I appreciate that, and I hope folks out there listening to this in a constructive way, because I think, you know, anything we can do to cut down the transaction cost, the transaction time, and get the money out where it's needed is certainly helpful. So, any other discussion? Okay. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye. Okay. Senator Walker, would you like to carry this?
Sure.
It's yours. Okay, now we'll switch councils. And we will open. Stall for time here for a minute. Open a work session on House Bill 2149.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, House Bill 2149 is a product of the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force. We previously heard it on the 7th of May. It relates to the ordering of alcohol assessment and treatment. ORS 471.430 sub 6 authorizes a court to order alcohol assessment and treatment for persons ages 18 to 20 who violate prohibitions relating to alcohol. The authority is not provided for persons ages 17 and younger. House Bill 2149 expands the statute to allow the court to order alcohol assessment and treatment for any underage person. For first-time underage offenders, the court has discretion whether to order the assessment and treatment. For repeat underage offenders, the assessment and treatment is mandatory.
Okay, we had the hearing on this fairly recently as well. I think the issue came up that the parents most likely would be responsible for this more underage crowd. And I'm not particularly concerned about that, but would welcome discussion if we have any in the committee. Okay, we are in work session. Senator Walker, would you like to make a motion?
Sure, Madam Chair. I'll move House Bill 2149 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2149 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. I will be opposing the motion. Understand the intent of the bill. I guess I just don't agree with it. I guess I just I have not been convinced that by the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force that we need to do more in this area of law.
Senator Beyer, any other discussion? Would you call the roll?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
No.
Chair Beyer? Aye. Okay. So ordered. I will carry that bill.
You know, Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
I just don't understand what the problem is, because in Lane County, you get referred to Looking Glass if you're under 18, and they do an alcohol assessment. Not all counties have such a program, so I think that's appropriate.
Well, they will now, Senator Walker.
Yes, they will.
Okay, if we can get this across the floor, that is. Okay, thank you. Are we done with our agenda? I believe we are. Any other discussion in the committee?
You cranked out all those bills while I was...
We did. See how efficient we are when you're not here, Senator Walker? Okay, on that happy note, we are adjourned.